Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled Sight Work, and it's about, well, a section, or named after a section, of the great collection of poems by Bob Wallachy named Fountain. And our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about sight work and this great book of poetry named Fountain. I was thinking about how to pronounce your name again.
You got it perfect.
I got it perfect, but I psyched myself out and forgot how to pronounce the word fountain. So this podcast is off to a great start. Yeah. But yes, Bob Wallachy is here to talk about Fountain, about his poetics. And if it's not too cheesy, I was wondering if you could start by reading your poem, Why I Write, which is the first poem in Fountain, but not in the section of sight work, because that's too much.
Oh, that's fine. Well, thanks for having me, first of all. And
thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Man.
And here's why I write. Because my heart is a bag of tools, and my eyes are painted on with plumber's grease. Because this weather of rust is raining from broken ceilings instead of sky, coloring me in half shades of regret. And I'm afraid of becoming a statue of bones, the cut, the ache, the whiskey, and the sweat. This spidering in and out of pipework, carrying the hair and the toothpaste and the day and the dead skin cells of the world. The earth is always under my fingernails. I'm the crack open, the reach inside, the song of rotten pipes, the shut mouth, hand over a nose or face, that stripped valve in your basement that spins and spins. I'm the stuffed shitter, the fixer, technician of dissonance, this auger's metal tongue screwing holes in hell, a sewer smell leaking into the air. I'm a smoke-filled flannel in a bar full of laughter, happy hour drafts drowning the dreams of men. I know there are exhaust pipes in pickup trucks that rattle like Buddhist mantras. There are rainbows in the grease trails of oil slicks. There are pieces of me that won't always be broken. And things I want to close into a hole, slide down the echo chamber of memory, and sometimes a 4-inch pipe is big enough to swallow this. I know there are pipes made to look like cathedral pillars and NASA space shuttles collecting dust in the basement of my nephew's school. I know flight sometimes has little to do with taking to the air, but a mind broken free from a clog. I know that most people don't question where their pipes go, just that there are people like me who bury them. I know every Mountain Dew bottle, drop of sweat, and broken shoelace I left behind in a ditch felt like an offering, that excavators leaving job sites sound like longing, and when I walk past construction sites, the stirred up dust makes me feel invisible. I know that my hand is a shark that has to keep moving, and hungers like this, I can smell them when they happen. The first cut, the first drop blossoming, slide the work gloves on and suck it up. Remember this. Don't ever tell anyone.
That is so good. Damn. Maybe we just, instead of me talking, we record your spoken word album. You know, and for me, the thing that I think about with your poetics, and talk about Fountain, and I definitely want to talk a little bit about Black Angels too today, and what I enjoy so much in this podcast is so much about me just geeking out over people who do things that I like, that I kind of know, and I just go, ooh, is, for me, all artistic expression goes back to those cave paintings in France. Like, they found those, like, 30,000-year-old handprints in France that is just like, you know, and that handprint says what? I was here, I am somebody, you know, and how and what do we do to make sense of our experience, and what do we do with all this stimulus in modern industrial life?
Yeah, I mean, when I started writing these work poems, it took a while to wrap my head around writing a poem about a job site or, you know, installing plumbing because I didn't find the poetry in it. And then I sort of got it reading the work of, like, Philip Levine, for instance, that, you know, that there was sort of like a, and I wasn't necessarily talking about myself per se, but there was sort of like a noble, like, grace to that type of work. And the smartest guy, one of the smartest guys I've ever met, didn't even graduate high school, and he couldn't, I've seen him try to even write a sentence, but I also saw this guy look at a blueprint, and he would lay out these lines and draw string lines up, and it would look like just this complicated artwork. And, you know, this guy was just such a genius for construction and laying out these complicated mathematics, and every pipe would be in the wall. And he would, I remember him spray painting a line and would say, "Bob, like, this is the center of your pipe. Just bring it up in here." And every pipe was in the, when the job was done. And I remember this target, when the target was done, like, I remember when this was a dirt hill. Mm-hmm. And now the pipe that he told me to bring up was in the exact center of that P trap. And, like, how did he figure out by looking on, like, this ripped set of blueprints and was able to figure it out? And that just, I marveled at that. And, like, there's a poem for these people. And I felt like that their story was not being told. And as I sort of matured as a writer, I felt that these stories were in me, and these stories were just dying to be told. And I think that you have to live this life to really bring some sincerity and bring some truth to it, and people write it in such a way that people believe that it happened, and it did.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think, you know, there's that, you know, and I say this as an educator, I mean, there's this way that education makes people who are brilliant think they're not, you know. Mm-hmm. and that sort of brilliance that you're talking about, or that way that, in this way, you know, I guess under capitalism or late capitalism, whatever, everything finds its own perfection and everything gets to the extreme, you know. And I think about the way that art and true literature has, you know, it has found its own perfection, but how many people have been left behind in that? And how do you bridge that gulf between, you know, this guy who wouldn't know Philip Levine, right? And how do you bring the power of that poetics to it? And I think that's so important, what you're doing, to sort of, yeah, record those experiences and make people understand.
The poetry, though, and this is one of the big challenges that I feel and I struggle with in my mind, is poetry is still such, unfortunately, an underground art. And if you look at, you go to any poetry reading, you look at the audience, and if you know most of the people in a given community, like the poetry community in Pittsburgh, most of the people that are attending poetry readings are writers, they're poets, they're professors. But how are we growing? How are we spreading that? You know, and one of the most gratifying experiences that I had was when I had a launch and I invited people that had never been to a poetry reading before. And their minds were just blown because they said to me, and in each one of them in different ways, it said basically the same thing. Like, I didn't know poetry could be about me. I didn't know it could be about things that I could care about. I didn't know that I would get it, you know. And it was sad. It's sad that the conception of contemporary poetry is something that is aloof, that is removed, and, you know, is not something for the masses, but it's something that only elite folks that have college degrees can, you know, ruminate about in coffee houses. It's not, you know.
Yeah, and I even say, like, the job that's been done. I mean, my students are terrified of poetry. Terrified of poetry, you know. But of course, you know, what is poetry to them, or the conception is, right? It's the sonnet. It's the Shakespearean sonnet. And not that those aren't great. But, you know, there's an incredible distance between my students' lived experiences and that sonnet, and how much thinking their way in that I have to coach them to do, you know. And, it's terror.
Well, interestingly, I started out, I was always drawn to being creative and I felt the need to have creative expression. And I'm a very visual person. I started out as a visual artist. But I remember, and I reached out to her, and it was kind of a cool story, my high school English teacher. I was never really interested in literature and poetry before this. But in high school, she introduced us to T.S. Eliot and Kafka and Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. Yeah. And my mind was just blown. And I it was just this fire just started in my brain. And I would talk to her and say, this is amazing. This is, I think I learned, found out what I wanted to do. And I didn't know writing could be this frank. I didn't know writing could be exciting. I didn't know writing. We could talk about our personal fears, our demons, our things that were personal to us. And so that really started a chain of events that led me to this, I guess. And I still feel like I'm a very visual person. I put that in my writing, but it's because of her that, that sort of started this for me. And I reached out to her recently and found her through her son on Facebook and said, I've got her address and mailed her my first chapbook. And I said, I don't know if you remember me, I was in your English class, but it was because of you, turning me on to poetry that now I've published my first chapbook. And she was so overjoyed. And she's like, this is why teachers teach. She says, success stories like that I made that kind of impression. And now look, what happened, but
it's the same thing, teaching this writing about lit course this semester. I had students, I made them read Kindred by Octavia Butler, and they were just like, I don't like novels, but this novel's so great. And I was like, I don't know if it's necessarily this novel. This is a great novel, but mm-hmm. I wanted to say to them, well, maybe you just never have gotten lost in a world that rich before. And isn't that what really good creative writing is? Is something people can get lost.
Oh, absolutely. I remember Saturday afternoons, and I still have a love of horror and sci-fi. And I remember sitting on my bed, and the blinds were open, the leaves were falling. It was October or something like that. And I was reading, I think it was The Exorcist.
Ah.
But the imagery of all the dead leaves flying through the air and reading this, I was so lost in this world that my sense of time was just non-existent. Yeah. And I didn't realize that 3 hours had passed. I was buried in this book. Oh, and that's what yeah. The wonderment of reading can do, I think, and transport you,
Yeah. And I think it's also connects people and bridges gaps. And I think another part of this may be the way the loss of how poetry and real literature has been so removed from, people. I had this experience, and maybe I'm just thinking about where we were at politically. I had this experience in grad school where we were reading a novel that was based in Lebanon in 1982, mm-hmm. when they had the little skirmish, civil war, whatever you call it. And the student who was from Lebanon, it was like, we would never read this in a literature class, about this conflict. And people know that there was this war that happened. And most people don't understand why. And it's not mm-hmm. taught in history. And he said, kind of insinuated, is well, this is the government just kind of this happened. And if we make a curriculum where people aren't engaged and forget about it, then it just goes away. And we were like, well, what do you read in English? He's like, oh, Shakespeare. We all read Shakespeare, all the English. And which, again, not to bag on Shakespeare. Shakespeare's great. But, and for me, it got to me to thinking about the power of words and the power of this kind of writing. For people to, that also allows people to think critically about their own experience.
Mm-hmm.
And what does it mean to deprive human beings of that tool?
Well, I know that, and I thought that sort of my feelings on writing have sort of kind of, they're constantly shifting, but I thought after my first chapbook, which was primarily about the death of my father, I thought that I would feel better about the situation in some way, that it would have changed me for the positive, but it didn't. But I felt healthier, and I felt like I understood my grief, and I felt that was a saving grace to me, and it changed me. But you know, being able to process that, but also in the way that was creatively fulfilling, was really important. And like I said, it constantly changes. The need to produce art to someone that's creative, you know, can have a lot of different reasons, and there's a lot of different motivations, you know, that change and motivate me to write. So, yeah.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, there's something to be said about just putting the world in symbolic order, you know, and how I love the way you say that. You just kind of feel healthier.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a different person, but I was able to understand my experience. Okay. And it may not be someone else's experience, but it is really a cool thing when someone comes up to you to reading and you read this really personal poem that you feel like this couldn't have happened to anyone else, or if it did, you know, I don't expect anyone to really, you know, be touched by it. But then this is, you know, this exact same thing happened to me. And it's usually the poems that I don't really think have any kind of connection to anyone else. And that's a really... this is like why I do readings. If one person comes up to me and says, wow, you know, I remember my grandfather and my grandmother and we were in a kitchen and this same thing happened to me, or, you know, this really spoke to me and you really captured it well. And, you know, poems have a number of lives to them. And I think for those who that don't do readings, I think the poem, I think, dies a little bit, and they're meant to be spoken aloud, and they're meant for other people to hear them. And I think we lose, when we don't do that, we lose the magic and the power that those written words have.
Yeah. You know? And I think too, another thing I want to touch on, what you said was, and I think it's so counterintuitive. I always tell my students, it's like the wintertime and driving advice, right? The more personal the poem, maybe the more relatable it becomes to other people. Mm-hmm. And it's like almost like wintertime driving, like the way to avoid the tree you're skidding at is to steer towards the tree you're skidding at or something, you know. Mm-hmm. It's weird how writing works that way, and it feels so deeply counterintuitive to it.
Well, and this kind of reminds me of something that Jan Beatty, who's one of my idols, said to me. She says, the uncomfortable experience, and I'm paraphrasing, but she says something like this: the disturbing, uncomfortable experience that you may have, go to it, you know, at full speed. That's what you need to write about. The thing that you're not sure that you want to write about, that's what you need to write about. And that's and what I got from that, and I found that to be very true, is that's where that energy is.
Yeah.
I love friction, and I love energy in writing, and I love poems that move, and poems that are sort of bristle with that sort of crackling energy and are kind of uncomfortable in a way. Yeah. But I want there to be some kind of music to it, though.
Yeah, and to find that sort of fault lines in experience.
It's been a challenge for me, because I had this conversation with a number of people and with myself when I'm writing these work poems. I'm like, men don't talk like this. Men don't have lyrical... And this is sort of the men in these poems, I should say, the men in this world don't look at the world this way, but I look at the world this way.
Yeah.
This is who I am as a poet. So it's like, how do I bridge that gap? How do I make the poem seem, genuine and have this sort of kind of like lyrical language? And that's something that I'm kind of working toward with some of my newer poems, and striking that balance between like the lyrical and the narrative, because I think that balance has a lot of energy to it. And instead of just being one way or the other, being so far up in the ether that the poem isn't grounded and the reader's kind of struggling, okay, where are we? What is this poem about? I never want a reader to think that or have that moment, but I don't want it to be so just plain spoken that there is no, you know, no magic or language.
Yeah. Which, on that note, can we talk about the poem Passage?
Absolutely.
14?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because I think for me, too, is I love the way, you know, when I do, and I'm just household handyman guy, but you know, when getting into a project, working with my hands, the way that just things just do strike me. And when I get into that brain, like when I get into that electrician brain,
mm-hmm.
you know, I had a day where I realized that the wire of this house was really fucked up. So, had to, you know, I literally spent an entire day, you know, figuring out the switch box down the basement, taking every plate cover off and just thinking like, okay, this is on that circuit and there's no mystery wires and there's no weird taps. Okay, we can go on. Mm-hmm. And like, I dreamt in electrical wire. I dreamt in circuitry that night.
That is so wild.
So wild? Yeah. I mean, that's that experience. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whenever I hear things come up in your poems about, you know, lines and, I was like, yeah, that is exactly where my brain goes when I dip a toe in that world.
Now, I used to think it was sad that I have dreams about offsetting drains and, but I think about like what I have to do the next day and, but there is a beauty to it and yeah. And seeing people that comes so naturally to them. I've had to work at it because I find myself, I'm living these two worlds where I'm the dreamer on one side and I'm the, you know, just completely logical builder on the other. And it is a totally messy and just kind of divided dichotomy that I kind of wrap my brain around and I struggle with. And it's sort of like, I feel like I'm Jekyll and Hyde in a way,
yeah.
Where I'm hiding this world from a lot of the people that I work with, because I feel like there would be a lot of judgment.
Yeah.
Because of the sort of like preconceived notion of what a poet is or what it means to be a poet and somehow less than.
Yeah.
You know? But you mentioned Passage.
Yeah, I love this poem.
Now, this really happened. Most of these poems, I mean, there's, you know, as most writers and poets have artistic license, but I had this experience where I was just lost in watching other people work. But as this poem progresses, and I can read this poem, but as this poem progresses, it sort of took on a different meaning for me. And if you want to...
Yeah, you know, yeah, okay. Absolutely. Yes, right. Yes.
Now, there's a term in this poem called rough-in. And for folks that don't know what roughing-in is, to a tradesman, specifically electrical or plumbing, it's taking the pipes or wires from where they're coming into a building and bringing them up. And when you're roughing in, you're putting the finish, you're installing the finishing pipes for like a sink or a toilet. So that's what roughing in is. It's taking the plumbing from like a stack per se and transitioning it to where you're making the final connections. So I do mention the term rough in this poem, Passage. When we didn't know what we wanted to be, they gave us hard hats to tell us. I was yellow, color of young and dumb, and full of everything I didn't know about Monday mornings in West Virginia, where 3 months of bitter cold 6 a.m.s are enough to say, fuck the rough-ins of big box stores, hollering distance from Bald Knob, stretching into Eagle Sky Country, the split earth of valleys and cattle farms and gas stations that sell everything. Here, I'll spend my whole day waiting for the cat backhoe to tear me a new one and a hole big enough for a grease trap and an entrance into hell. 3 days later, I'll return to the living and blow air into my hands, watch the 10 Mexican carpenters shoot nails into studs after crossing the border on the emergency brake to build walls for the snack bar at Target. They lean shoulders into wood, speaking in the buzzsaw language of faster and do it now. My head inside their hive as I turn away from the pipes and keep watching. Song of their bodies. Song of what all of us had to do to survive another day in this needling air. I remember our foreman who called them rats, then drank coffee and watched all of us eating together from his heated job trailer. But by noon, it's warm enough to sit on the mountain of broken bricks and backfill, the sun blazing behind our heads, blackening out the shade of us until we are nothing but gesture, an arm inside a cooler to pass out bottles of water, fingers touching for a second, our hands reaching out to each other, dripping water, our skin shining.
So yeah, this poem does go, you know, this seems to be this part, yeah, of your experience and then looking at and exploring other people's experiences mm-hmm. on what, yeah, I mean, what a job site is and like, how do you capture that? Yeah, a Target in West Virginia.
Yeah. I remember these guys, these carpenters, and they all sat at break and they sat in the row. And I've changed brakes before, and I know what rotors look like. And I saw what looked like this rotor that I've never seen a rotor just shredded to bits like this rotor was. And I'm like, what happened here? Like, what is this? And I was talking to a guy who knew one of the workers and said that they crossed the border on the emergency brake to get here.
Wow.
And I was just, it didn't really hit me at the time. But with the, as this poem started to ruminate in me, and this poem's maybe about a year, maybe a year or two old, that I saw the gravity of that with the sort of the political state that our country's in right now, and the state of immigration, and what that meant to those people, and the struggle that that they did, and they're risking their lives to come here to work. And I really had no grasp of that at the time. And I was really privileged, and now I sort of kind of understood in a way, you know, in a small way, some of the struggles that they had, and seeing what they had gone through. It was quite something.
Yeah, that's a wow. Yeah, how dangerous, how terrifying.
Mm-hmm. And it was there was 10 of them, and they all came in this small compact car. So I can't even imagine.
Wow, the terror and the stress of driving
that. Yeah, how they must have fit in that car, all of them.
Yeah, and then every time you hit the brake, the way that the car would pull and.
Right.
Wow. Just to work, just to build a snack bar at Target.
Mm-hmm. And seeing some of these buildings and when they're finished and everything that's behind the wall. We went in, I remember we were trimming out, and trimming out is when you're setting the china, the porcelain, and the sinks, and installing faucets and things like that. And when this building was opened, and I just took one look at that snack bar, and there were people in the snack bar and getting popcorn, and just completely oblivious to the sweat and the blood that went into
building that snack bar,
a damn Target.
But,
you know?
And isn't it, I mean, I think it's a great metaphor for what your poetics do, but also what an amazing metaphor for America,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just this lives that we live of just, snack bar, and, you mm-hmm. know, maybe the coffee's not hot enough, and, isn't that the worst thing? And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just we have this kind of, like, glittering, I don't even know it's glittering anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with this really consumerist,
there's expectation that everything's provided for you, and you can just walk into a Target and get, you know, a caramel latte, and you know. Meanwhile, the hundreds of men and the brains and the engineering that went, you know, into building a building like this, you know, I had no concept of either, and it was quite in awe of that, and you know, it was something that really struck me and. Made it into this poem.
Yeah, I mean, what's that line from... actually, I don't even know the Walt Whitman poem where he's looking at the cornfield and talks about quintillions and quintillions of corn or whatever.
And who knows what quintillion means?
Right? Quintillion is just a big-ass number.
Yeah.
Unimaginably big-ass number.
Okay.
A big, unimaginably big-ass... And we live in a world of unimaginably big-ass numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And yeah, I had a friend... Oh, not a friend. Actually, he was a student. What am I saying? I need more coffee. I had a student... who, back when I taught public speaking, I had the first speech I had him do was a demo speech. It was just demonstrate how to do something. And he worked at Pizza Hut. And he had brought in all of the special tools that make a Pizza Hut pizza, right? There's actually a little plastic ring that goes in over the dough so that the crust is perfect every time and you don't get any sauce.
And it's
on
a Pizza Hut crust, right?
And it's a Pizza Hut crust.
Wow.
And but he said every Pizza Hut he had worked, like he worked for this guy who owned like five Pizza Huts and mm-hmm. he would bounce between every Pizza Hut had a poster in the back that said, if every Pizza Hut weighs 2 ounces of ounces of shredded cheese a day, not just per pizza, 2 ounces of shredded cheese a day, it'll cost Pizza Hut $14 million. Which is such a weird...
What are you supposed to do with that information?
Well, don't put, you know, only use the size cup that they use to dump into the pizza, the shredded cheese thing, and don't make sure that cup is level.
Mm-hmm.
And only put that amount of cheese on your Pizza Hut pizza. Because if you put that extra pinch on there, that's $14 million.
I thought you were going to say, if you waste 2 ounces of cheese, we, you know, you could feed a country of whatever, but...
Yeah, you could do that, too.
It was less noble.
Less noble. No, you're costing, you're stealing $14 million. But yeah, just to think about, yeah, like those tar, and they're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we just float past them in our cars, and we don't even think about...
Right, and we complain that the next one is only 3 miles down the road.
It's only 3 miles.
Why isn't it closer?
Yeah, why isn't it closer? And that one sucks. Go to the cool one or whatever, which is like...
I think we forget the kind of privilege that we have here, and yeah. You know, despite our complaints and the state of things, which are in a mess, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, not to change gears.
Change gears.
For a... podcast that's a lot about poets and punk rockers.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about this section?
Sure.
Die Test mm-hmm. from this. And mm-hmm. there's also that great poem in Black Angels, What I Learned from Robert Smith.
I love that.
Yeah. I love that too. Because I think I would be remiss. I would be a sellout. I'd be a loser if I did not mention this section,
mm-hmm.
This thematic unit in Fountain. And if you want to talk about it, it's, what is it? 18 to 29.
Yeah.
In Fountain. Now, those of you who buy. By the way, where can people get these books? What is the best place for people to get these books?
Well, Main Street Rag has their website, and they can buy it directly from the website.
I will post the link to that on the podcast.
Okay, great.
And for Black Angels?
Mm-hmm. Black Angels is on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the easiest way that they can buy Black Angels.
Okay, I will post the link to that as well. And I guess if you're in Pittsburgh, these are around. Are these around in local?
I'm embarrassingly been remiss in my duties of spreading the book around, but I'm slowly doing that. And yes, I'm making my way around to all the local bookstores.
And there is a launch party for launch reading for Fountain coming up soon, isn't it?
No, not yet. I've not scheduled it yet. No. I'm sort of kind of dipping my toe in that water, and we'll definitely be making an announcement when I do launch the book.
And if people want to follow you as a poet, is there a good place for them to...
Facebook's probably the easiest. I've not created a website yet for myself, but I'm constantly posting events, what's coming up, what's going on with me on Facebook, on my Robert Wallachy Poet Facebook page.
I will post a link to that as well.
Okay, great.
Great. And so anyway,
yeah.
Die Test.
Right.
Poet, punk, parker things. Do you want to talk about this section,
sure.
or what inspires this section? Or
well, music.
Pick your favorite poem from this section, maybe to read. That'd be cool too.
Sure. Music has always been, and reading this whole book, even in some of the work poems, music finds its way in through some of the work poems. But music has always been really important to me. It's been a part of who I am and my sort of identity. And growing up, I remember these groups like The Cure and Depeche Mode and The Smiths, and they're living my life through their lyrics and feeling like what they were saying was really speaking to me. And it was a really profound thing that I sort of carry, I still carry with me in terms of my love for music. But in growing up and sort of becoming in those formative years and high school years, that alternative music was really kind of dominated my mindset and who I was about and what I was interested in. And there was a I'm going to read one of these poems. It's called City Limits. And there's a place that is no longer, the building is still there, but it's a dance company now, and it's in Penn Hills. It's a place called City Limits, and this nightclub had nothing but new wave, alternative, and punk music. And all the people were super cool, and there were goths, there were punks, there were new wavers, and everyone was smoking, or at least to me, it felt like everyone was smoking these clove cigarettes. And so there was like this weird kind of wonderful aroma when you walked into this place. And these were all the misfits. These were all the people that I felt didn't fit in. And I felt like I never fit in. So when I was coming to this, when I would go to this place, I feel like I was kind of going into my tribe. You know, these were my people, you know. So this poem is about that place, City Limits. Before I was lost, I was found, crammed in the back seat on laps of other goth kids and drinking our way past oblivion to a crematorium turned club. I rubbed my face white in the parking lot. I didn't know how to draw a face on, how to enter my body. We jackknife shots we lifted from shops, stuffed into overcoat pockets. Four was enough to turn us out of ourselves and blow us through stapled up doors, crooked rooms spinning into back room bathrooms, cracked mirrors, retching up whatever was inside us to pounding beats. Our hair intact, we entered the dance floor renewed, shaking it off with wine glasses full of coke, for the under 21 in us, wanting more but settling on Depeche Mode and the flock of seagulls. Lifting my head above the disco smoke, wishing.
But again, I think that's one of those. I remember reading an interview with the band Marat, and they put out this great record in like 1999 called Kids in Philly. Mm-hmm. And there's a line in there about the Golden Donut, and the Philly City Paper person asked them, like, "Well, do you think people outside of Philly are going to understand this Golden Donut reference?" And he said, Dave Bilanco, the lead singer, said, "If everybody's lucky, they have a Golden Donut. It's not going to be called the Golden Donut," mm-hmm. but you had City Limits.
Right.
And I think it's also the way that, like, that music, especially of that era, you know, we're of a similar vintage, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, not that there's not music of this era that does that, but it's just, it's such a more compelling idea of reality. And it really is this way of, yeah, I love the line, turn us out of ourselves. Mm-hmm. Four enough was enough to turn us out of ourselves. And the way that there's like a sense of freedom that comes from being in that kind of a scene.
Well, I don't mention like Catholicism, but I feel like people that are grow up Catholic are more, there's a lot that you hold in and you're not allowed to express yourself. And I think a lot of people experience that.
Thank you for saying it.
Where they were stifled, their creativity was stifled and their identity and who they are and the music that they loved. And, you know, I remember, especially in the Robert Smith poem, where my grandmother saw the poster in my room of Robert Smith. And I was watching, I think, 120 minutes at the time. And she's like, "Who's that weirdo on TV?" Yes. And like, I'm a weirdo too. I want to be a weirdo, you know?
Which actually, now that you mention it, I do have... Did you read this one too?
Oh, sure.
Black Angels? Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
This is about me geeking out. I'm sorry. I want to hear Bob Wallachy read the Robert Smith poem, damn it.
Right.
So here we are.
And this is what I learned watching Robert Smith. And I get into a Cure concert that was the most amazing concert I've ever been to. One of the most amazing concerts. It was 3 hours long, I remember.
Wow.
And Robert Smith, The Cure, played encore after encore after encore. And it was the eve of my senior year in high school. Like that next day was Monday, and we had to go to school the next day. And we drove to Ohio to see The Cure.
Wow.
And it was like such a rebellious thing to do at the time.
Yes.
And the funny thing was, and I'll get into this in the poem, that every encore that The Cure did, they like launched into this really slow, like depressing song. And it usually encores are most concerts you go to, the songs are uplifting, but not with The Cure.
No, never with The Cure.
What I learned watching Robert Smith. In 1994, when Robert Smith enters your bedroom, you play it cool. Even if he's scotch taped to the walls, underworld clown from your teenage hell, that weirdo your grandmother called him. In this shot, his hair is electric, crazed with shock, a wind tunnel of aquanet, that red-lipped boy from Blackpool. Soon your mother will worry about you. Your father, who hopes the freak phase passes, will listen by the door while you mainline MTV and your eardrums, New Order, The Smiths, and more sissy music like this. Before your last day of senior year, you will leave the house under cover of darkness. So much will depend on how soft the front door closes. If that Ford Fiesta will be there waiting, with 200 miles between you and in Cleveland, one busted transmission, and 5 tickets to see The Cure, Robert Smith, pull up his tortured ass, bolted down to that stage. Dear beautiful turnstile, dear mime left out in the rain, I want to drive into the wreck of those screaming guitars. Listen to him belt out close to me in pictures of you, the mic so close he could kiss it. Sing out his British heartbreak and tear up my 18 years as if they were nothing. Searchlights flooding the stage, my hand over my ears, trying to hold so much in.
So what was the venue in Cleveland? I just got to ask.
You know what? I'd have to look it up. I don't remember, but I remember when I was writing this poem, I was looking it up, and I don't have an answer for you right now on that.
I'll figure it out. Okay. 1994 Cleveland. If you just Google anybody listening on the podcast,
right.
Google 1994 Cure Cleveland, it'll come right up. Maybe there might be a live bootleg out there. There might be. Oh, but it's just such a better idea of the world. All right, so I'm done geeking out. So okay. Now let's talk about what you want to talk about. The question I hit Bart with in the last podcast. Of the poems from Fountain, for you, which ones really capture where you are now as a poet and maybe where you're going as a poet?
Okay. Well, something we kind of touched on a little bit when we were talking about how, yeah, I still wanted to write these narrative poems, but I wanted there to be something more. Yeah. And I sort of like realize something about that as I'm such a visual person. I want the description to kind of take someone somewhere and have some power to the language. And there's a couple poems. I'm going to read one of these. It's actually in, let's see what section. It's actually in the section Fountain, page 49. Mm. It's called Wet. Mm. Into those warm, wet fields again and again where we came, pulled by the blur of light after the last soccer game in the July dark. We walked off into the veil of torn chain links, broken bottles, hungry for the rush and waiting for the sweet hit of a cherry, wondering what it'll be like to be stoned. Our heads weightless and drifting back under the spinning floodlight bats and rain. Abandoned baseball field becoming mud, becoming landslide. There was no name for us yet. We were too young for that kind of fear. Too young to hear the stories of kids disappearing like a passing storm. Not thinking we wanted to disappear too, into the lush ooze of skunk and smoke till that wash of laughter found us, softening the memory of what we didn't have, who would never be. We hunched down in a circle as if the burnt inch of our passing was sacred, sharing our hot breath in the thrush of summer crickets, the fall of rain, needling our bodies under the dark swirl of sky, naming us there, and waking us back into this hard life, running into thunder from the crack of our voices, saying, see you tomorrow, yeah, see you later, and stay dry, man, be safe. Here's another one that I'll just, I want to read real quick, and then we can talk about it.
Yeah.
In this poem, and this is something that, now in Black Fountain, Black Fountain, Black Angels,
Black Angels,
as some of you that have the book know the cover, there's a hard hat on the cover, there's a lot of work poems are kind of central to that collection, and I sort of carry that over into Fountain, but I sort of wanted to expand that into blue-collar life and living, growing up that way, and what are the types of people that grow up in this environment and what do they become? And this poem, Railed, kind of gets into that. And growing up, Pittsburgh is also, I love Pittsburgh poems. And
something I didn't know I wrote a lot about, and someone told me, you seem to write a lot about Pittsburgh, but in any case, here's this poem. It's called Railed, page 21. Down where the steel reaches through turns, patches of grass poking through cracks. You could disappear behind hills and steal cans of Red Bull, go running the railroad home behind Giant Eagle, next to shores of washing machines and beater cars, past the bluffs of mud, embankment of the Allegheny, and the waters of steel, where I watch tides split the gray with its stinking darkness. But on Saturdays, we lifted off from the one tree that survived the tire swing on a rotten branch, and took turns pushing each other over the garbage dump hills, mattresses and smash TVs, to reach above the rising fumes, bare legs pumping and pumping to get higher than the drift, carrying open barges, the rust and trash thick waves from runoff and waste treatment plants, spilling out its seed into the deep, envious of its leaving our Rojas lives, our dying fathers and struggling mothers who raised families, answered phones, and scrubbed toilets, thinking as long as we lived would never be like them.
That's Pittsburgh, all right.
Yep.
Yeah. I had the advantage of not growing up here, but, mm-hmm. you know, thinking about those two poems, Wet and Railed, and how... Yeah, well, I mean, what this landscape does to people, or what does it mean to grow up in the post-industrial, you know, and how it creates these fringe spaces.
Right, it's sort of like this weird apocalypse where it's lacking an identity, and it's not, you know, we're not in the steel era anymore. We're not in, you know, in a lot of these communities, McKeesport, and, yeah. you know, these communities that they're still struggling. They still have not found their rebirth, their yeah. renaissance. And Lawrenceville, I never thought Lawrenceville. I remember Lawrenceville was a hole, and yeah. there was a ton of old man bars, and there was a vacuum store and a Five and Dime, and like not much else going on. And now look at it, and you know, it's gentrified, and there's a lot of negativity with that. But in some cases, you know, things are surviving, and things are sort of undergoing a renaissance, and there's something positive about that as well.
Yeah, and I think to have, which was the thing that drew me to Western Pennsylvania, thing that drew me to Pittsburgh and, well, Western Pennsylvania in general, is like just this idea of ruins. Mm-hmm. This idea of ruins and fringe spaces, you know, the abandoned baseball field and these places that you can tell were something was something. I was walking around McKeesport today. It's where my wife, where her school is. It was career day at her school, so I wanted to talk at career day at her school. And I had to get some lunch, so I was walking around downtown McKeesport.
Did you find a place to...
There's a subway.
Okay.
There's a subway that somebody had actually apparently probably driven their car into, physically into the subway.
Wow.
And so I knew there was a subway. This guy, I rounded the corner, and there's this sign, and there's glass and light, and then there's these two giant pieces of plywood, and one of them was on a hinge, and that was the door.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I looked in there and I was like,
oh my God,
there is a car size hole in the front of this store. And, you know, some elderly person, probably in like an Explorer or something, they could jump the curb, mistook the gas for the brake, and like quit their car, I think, yeah. into this subway.
Oh my God.
Yeah. But, you know, but I was like, oh, this is classy. At least in this part of McKeesport, there's boards over the windows. You know, the places that are so abandoned and so in that weird post-industrial gothic way that like people don't even, there's not even enough care to, you know, secure the outside.
Well, it's like I worked briefly for a company that was headquartered in downtown McKeesport, and I wonder now, like, what does living in a place that is so depressed do to a person, you know?
Yeah.
Even that a person that doesn't have all the strikes against them, but just psychologically, what does that do to you?
Yeah, well, you know, I have a lot of family in Johnstown. Mm-hmm. I have friends from St. Francis who stayed up the mountain, who, you know, and that place is weird. Altoona's functional. Evansburg's functional. Beyond that circle, Carrolltown is like the edge, mm-hmm. right? And then I went for a drive last summer, and It's weird how those little bubbles are better than when I was. Because when I went to college out there, everywhere I looked when I was in a car or in my own car, it was a grunge video background. Like, oh, look, we can go near that farm equipment. Alice in Chains should be there in that barn. You know, right. That's the barn from Man in the Box video right there. It was everywhere. Those little places are functional.
Mm-hmm.
But if you leave that bubble and drive your car another 10, 20 minutes, it looks exactly the abandoned Giant Eagle in Northern Cambria is still there.
It's so just weird and like ghostly almost.
It is ghostly and weird. And yeah, I do wonder about like my friends, my family, other people I know from John, like, what is that like when you feel like you're living in a grave or something, you know?
Right.
What's, yeah. You know, and it's weird because it's like you do have an emotional attachment to it, but then you also know you got to get the hell out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you survive, you get out, you survive.
Right.
You know, all the right moves. Mm-hmm. I have that downstairs in the living room to watch at some point. But, mm-hmm. you know, and at what point is that movie a documentary of people's lives and no longer is a drama, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm terrified of writing poems that have any kind of political underpinnings, but I think it's kind of because I feel that it's so difficult to do, to be genuine at it, unless you're really living it, because one of my favorite poets, Martín Espada, wrote this poem about 9/11, and he didn't write it about 9/11, but it's called Alabanza, and what I think is so powerful about the poem is he's writing it from the perspective of these workers, these food service workers that are working in one of the buildings. Mm. And that is so incredible and is so personal. And I feel like I can relate to yeah. people that are working in the, and these are individuals in this poem. He mentions, he singles out these workers and who they are and their identity. And it just really takes on this,
yeah.
this kind of myth of a lost America and you know, we are political people, even if we don't yeah. think we are. And I think, you know, there are times when we have an obligation to speak about the world, our world, and it's dying and it's crumbling and struggling. And
yeah.
we, as the mouthpieces of the generation, the poets, the writers, we have that obligation, whether we want it or not, you know.
Yeah, and I think in such a way, I mean, even just the idea of recording experience and thinking through other people's experiences
mm-hmm.
is itself a political act these days. And thinking about what's behind those walls. I mean, you saying that about 9/11 and the workers. My sister-in-law actually had a meeting. It was supposed to be in the World Trade Center at 9/11.
Really?
And she had a reservation at the top of the towers to have breakfast at 9:30.
Wow.
Yeah. And she said it was the best Belgian waffles she's ever had in her entire life. Was at the top of the World Trade Center. And so, yeah, thinking, you know, I mean, when it happened, I was emailing back and forth to Danelle, and I was like, isn't Heather supposed to be in New York today? Isn't she supposed to be?
Wow.
Yeah. And there was about 20 minutes where she couldn't get her sister on the phone.
Oh.
But yeah, she said, yeah, I had a breakfast reservation in that, you know, with those workers making those waffles,
mm-hmm.
those really great waffles, supposedly. It's amazing to think of.
It is. You know? The implications of that and, yeah. you know, wow.
Yeah. And actually somebody goofed. Somebody did not reserve the conference room. They forgot and ended up at the Sony building. Somewhere else in Manhattan, and then she ended up not going. She's like, I was feeling sick. I'll Skype in or whatever.
How far was the Sony building from the World Trade Center?
Far enough.
Far enough? Okay.
Far enough to be safe. Far okay. enough that those people
But still,
were okay.
she wasn't feeling well and didn't...
She didn't leave Philadelphia, and she was just going to call in,
mm-hmm.
and people she worked with were... But yeah, somebody just goofed. They did not reserve the conference room.
But there are people that she worked with that were in the Trade Center?
They weren't.
Oh, they were not.
They okay. were not, yeah. Okay. So.
Wow. Man.
But yeah, it's crazy. It's absolutely insane. What a century.
Yeah, certainly.
What a weird century we're living in. I thought the 20th was fucked up, but.
Yeah, This might have topped that.
Is just, I don't like it.
No, I don't.
Not a fan. Wouldn't recommend to friends.
No, it's surreal. I never thought that this person that calls himself the president would be our president.
Okay. I've said this on this podcast a million times. Sorry for the 8 of you who are like hardcore listeners. But there's this man named Zygmunt Bauman. He passed away in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a European social theorist, also European Jew, born in Poland in 1925. So, I mean, he saw some things. And he talked about maybe is this moment in history, the interregnum. Are we, the interregnum being the monarch has died, we have not had the new ceremony to install the new king. And is this just period in history, the late 20th century, early 21st, are we just living through this? The future is going to be different, but it's not here yet. And are we living through the dying of the 20th century? The old king is dead. The 20th century king is dead. And mm-hmm. we haven't found our 21st century monarch and way of living yet. And is this sense of anxiety and decay? And let's face it, constant death of celebrities who did cool shit during our childhood. And the fact that we're going to have probably an octogenarian president. In the middle of, you know, right. the world that's moving even faster and deeper into the, you know.
So these times are the days between the days that matter.
Yeah. Yeah. It sucks to live through that. Yeah. That my 20s, 30s, probably 40s will be that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think there is hope for the future. But it's just really sucks to live through this right now.
It does. It does. But it has helped me that I write and other people write and that yes. we have these readings. And I said this, I think it was my last verse, where I said, you are my church.
Yeah.
You know, these readings are to a large extent, you know, a sacred space for me.
Yeah.
And a lot of people I think have felt that, and they felt that they could reveal things or they could read these poems yes. that they were uncomfortable with even showing to someone, but in that space, in that sort of, you know, sacred space, this safe space that we're all supportive. We're all in your corner. We all have these types of stories and poems. And, yes. You know, that's what I love about this poetry community here.
Yeah. And I always say, I have a young friend, Noah, who's probably listening, who's been on this podcast. I always say whenever he has sports angst, he'll text me, my team lost. And I'll say, sometimes I'll just say, listen, art, literature, and music, those teams never lose. They're undefeated.
Exactly.
Just go with it, you know.
Yeah, they won the championship again.
They won the championship again. So can we have one more poem before we go to the bottom five of your choosing, sir?
Sure. Anything in particular? Or
no, you're the poet's choice. Poet's okay. choice.
All right. I'm going to read this kind of very stripped-down narrative poem. And this is for... So on page 66, and I'm dedicating this poem to one of the best male poets in Pittsburgh, Jason Irwin, because he also wrote an amazing barbershop poem. So I sent this poem to him. I says, here's my barbershop poem inspired by you. It's called Classic Cuts. Sideways hat and tattooed hands. I watch Ace, the 30-something barber I found via the internet in Lincoln Road. Down the gravel runoff behind the dollar store and cut-rate beer. Ace asks how I found him, and we talk about old-school barbers, how you can't find them anymore. I think about Jerry, where I used to go, the 80-something grandpa who called me Longshanks even though I was bald. Told the same stories every time about his World War II bride, beautiful and flaking apart on the unframed photo on the wall. He'd adjust rabbit ears so all of us watching could watch the big college football game. The pitcher shaking every time a neck was buzzed. The hum and old man smell of aftershave and talc slapped on shaved skin. And laughter. Jerry asking me if he could trim that jacked up beard of mine. I learned of his death from the pile of papers outside his shop. And Ace talking about it. His flat screen blasting People's Court and commercials for hover rounds and Mucinex. Driving home past the closed True Value Hardware in a vacuum shop, I wonder if anyone will remember me, stop somewhere and tell stories of how things used to be, the better days when I was here.
So good. Yeah, the better days when I was here. Well, I mean, hey, are these registered with the Library of Congress?
Yeah.
Well, there you go. You're forever. You're forever. The internet's forever until the planet poles reverse, and maybe at some point I'll, you know, just go full hipster and just get these podcasts lathe cut into vinyl records and just do it that way.
Hey, vinyl's back, man.
Vinyl's back, and you know, the Library of Congress, if you submit a sound file to them, that's how they keep it.
Really?
They lathe cut it into vinyl.
Wow.
It's more stable than digital.
I'm so glad vinyl came back. And,
yes.
You know.
It's nice, and cassettes are, you know.
I know, but like the days when, you know, this is why, you know, my sadness with downloads was because I remember the days when you'd get an album, right? And it would be in plastic, okay? And the vinyl would be in plastic. And you'd take off the vinyl, you could smell the cover. And then you flip it over and you'd read about the artist, you know? And you stare at that album art, right?
Yes.
And you could hear that crackling. Between the songs. And
You know, my friend Derek keeps talking about how, you know, before the internet too, if you wanted to find out what the other cool bands were, you'd have to look in the acknowledgement section of the liner notes.
Oh, really? Okay.
They would say thank you too, blah 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 blah, and you were like, oh, this band is friends with these bands. These bands are probably cool too. And that was your way of figuring it
that
out.
That was our internet.
Yeah, and dual cassette decks with high speed dubbing. That was our piracy. Mm-hmm.
But then we would go to these record stores and we would talk to the people that worked there. And there was such a, and we would learn about other artists. And that was where the sense of community got lost.
Yeah, I mourned Soundcat, Paul's.
You know, friendships, that whole thing. You know.
All of it. All right, so this collection in particular is called Fountain. And again, the best place to get it is through, the Main Street Rag. Actually, it's mainstreetrag.com, spelled exactly like you would think it would be spelled. But I will put the link on the podcast. Black Angels is available through Amazon. Bob Wallachy Poet on Facebook. I'll have links to that.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready for the bottom five?
Yeah, whatever that may mean.
Okay, the bottom five. It's now time for the bottom five. A series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature, Bob. Are you ready?
I'm so not ready, but go ahead.
Okay, question one. Tell me, it's not even a question, it's a prompt.
Okay.
Tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory from your childhood. And I always preface this by saying, Clarify, it's not when you went to Disney World,
right.
But it was the day it rained and you made cookies or something, and mom made cookies or something.
Okay. I think this fits perfectly. And it's kind of cheesy, but I'm just going with it. I remember my grandmother used to take care of some watch us when our parents worked. And I remember this one summer when... I hadn't known the place had opened up around the corner from her house. And she said, you know, there's a candy shop that opened. I'm like, what? And she says, here's a dollar. And it was back in the days when a dollar could actually get you something. Yeah. And I went in this candy shop and it was like Willy Wonka's like Wonderland. And I remember these giant Swedish fish. And I got like two of these giant Swedish fish and a Mork and Mindy like playing cards with that like stale cardboard gum that came with it. And it was so amazing. Like, my dollar stretched so far. Oh, my God. He's unwrapping the gum.
Don't put this in your mouth. This came from a pack of 91-92 Opeachy hockey.
Oh, my God.
But here's the gum.
Matt is holding the gum right now.
You can sniff it. It kind of smells. If you put it in your mouth now, it will, like, immediately turn to dust.
Oh, I just broke it.
It's funny where that came from.
Oh, shit.
It will immediately turn to dust. And suck all the liquid out of your mouth, and you will not feel okay for at least a day.
This is like as thick as like 10 communion wafers. But it's holier.
It is
so holier.
Oh, yeah, that Topps gum, man. Here it is. Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's so great. Yeah. That's my happy memory of going to that candy store and buying Star Wars cards and, you know, Morgan Mini and hockey and football and all these wonderful things and Nerds candy. You know? Wow.
Yeah.
And that was the only business. And ironically, on that stretch, and ironically, now, that same building, the building's there, the business that is there is a dentist. How great's that?
That is perfect. That's closing the loop.
Yep.
All right. Question two, also a prompt, I guess. Name a film world you would like to visit or live in permanently. Like, if you could, like Gumby style, jump into a DVD and just live in the world of that movie, is there a film world you would like to, or at least vacation in? 2 weeks in.
That is so hard to pick just one. One of my favorite films is The Godfather, and it's, you know, my wife is, she's like perplexed with my like fascination with mafia, and because they're all assholes and they're horrible people, but Francis Ford Coppola romanticizes it in a way that seems that makes you want to yearn for the life, and Vito Corleone's life in Italy. I just wanted to go into that movie and live in those vineyards, and I could just smell the olive oil, and it just seemed like such a wonderful environment. Family was so important, even though it was kind of messed up with, you know, their perception of what family was or meant. But in the same breath, there was a sort of romanticism about it that I loved, and thought that it was a better world, you know? And I justified it by thinking to myself, well, you know, they're criminals, but they're principled about it. And, you know, they're business people. Yes. So that's my weird effed up justification.
That makes sense. Yeah, Godfather. Yeah. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Question three. Have you had any weird encounters with celebrities?
Yes. And it was like half of an interaction, but it was in Metropole, which used to be, there was this nightclub in Metropole in the Strip District. And I can't even remember who I was seeing, or if it was just like a dance night or whatever. But I walk into the men's room, and they had a payphone in the men's room. And there was sort of this corridor when you walk in, a corridor, and there was a payphone right there. And James Spader was on the phone, wow. You know? And he was just like, and his character in the movies, he was like, if anyone could play or be the character that is in his movies, that was what was happening at the time. And he was just like this, like, really, like, just off-put and just kind of like this arrogant guy, and was just having this conversation, really wasn't interested in the conversation. He was like, yeah, whatever. And I'm like, that's James Spader. I'm like, and that's James Spader's character in the movies.
in the bathroom.
He was like this, like, you know, cool, but like this arrogant prick on the telephone in the men's room at Metropole.
That's so amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing you walked into a, so you did walk into a movie, so these are related to each other.
Yes.
All right, question four, kind of a sci-fi question. If you could choose, would you prefer to be able to move through time or space without human limitations? If you had to choose one of those superpowers, I don't know what to call a superpower, but if you could just snap your fingers and either be in a different time, or snap your fingers and in present day be in a different spot in the world, which would you choose?
Oh, definitely be time.
Time?
Yeah. Not that I think that I would correct some of the things that I did wrong, or, and that would be sort of more my motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe kind of get out of my, and I think it would be my motivation for some of the things that discover art earlier and write earlier and do some of those types of things instead of fucking around and wasting a lot of time, you know? But here's the sort of kind of weird existential question. Would I be knowledgeable? Would I have the knowledge that I have now going back? Or would that memory, would the memories of what I've learned and the wisdom be wiped out?
Yeah,
you know?
Ooh, yeah.
Because then would I make those same choices?
No, maybe probably not.
You know?
Yeah, Maybe you needed that experiential knowledge or that delay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's just some stuff.
But then would I have met the people that I've met? Would I have gone,
yeah.
You know, would I have walked in the theater and made a left and not a right? And would that choice have, you know, implications where I may have not have met a friend or had that relationship? And, you know, so it's kind of like mind blowing when you think about how everything's connected and our choices kind of, whether we're conscious of it or not, kind of affect our entire life.
All right. Wow. That was heavy. So question five, much lighter, perhaps, hopefully. Question five, we're almost through this. Another prompt, actually. Maybe I shouldn't call them bottom five questions anymore. Tell me about the worst car you've ever driven.
Oh, wow. Driven?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe not necessarily your car, but the worst car you've ever driven.
Well, I learned to drive in this Honda Civic. And this thing was like, the doors on this thing must have weighed, to me at the time, they weighed like 150 pounds a piece. It was so heavy. And I remember like the car always pulled to one side. I don't even know what that meant at the time or, you know, if it was a bearing or what it was. But it was one of the cars I learned on and it had 350,000 miles on it.
Wow.
And it was still going. And I can't remember how long we had that car, but.
Do you remember what year it was?
No, I don't. No. It was blue. It was like this faded, like navy blue with these like red and white, like racing stripes almost.
My God, 1,000 miles on it.
Yeah. And it was still going strong and it was loud. It probably had, you know, holes in the muffler and everything else, but it was like, it was a car, you know, and it got you from point A to point B, but it was like scary to drive this thing. And you felt like, you know, I'm going to die in this thing.
It was probably a good learning car.
Yeah. It got you to put your foot on the brake at the right time and really drive the speed limit. And, you know,
which is maybe the perfect teen driver car.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I wasn't a lead foot after that.
That's solid. All right. I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something, I guess. I think actually maybe Chris Collins might be.
Oh, wonderful.
It might be the next episode. Our homepage where you'll find new and old episodes is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podcast Addict, and when I remember, Mixcloud. And I haven't for months, but you know, go check out Mixcloud. There's some classic episodes up there. Follow us on Twitter at Gonna Die Podcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Thank you, Bob Wallachy. And again, check out these books, Fountain. Check out Black Angels, MainStreetRag.com. I'll have all the links on the website and Bob Wallachy author, or Bob Wallachy poet, Facebook page as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Thank you so much, Bob, for doing this.
Oh, man, thank you for having me. This was a blast.
This was best. This is one of our better episodes. And thank you to Andrew Fox for the theme music. Later, meets. 2, 3, 4.